Then we go to another Italian pear. Ah, now the Italian, this pear is marked as taglia tre, size number 3. And in view of your ankle problem, I took the precaution of measuring the inside leg.
Yes.
Now, it's difficult to know to what extent one ought to stretch that woolly material
that
when
woolly
measuring
material,
it.
When
measuring but I've it, given it a medium stretch, whatever that may mean. And I make it about 28 inches inside leg.
Inches inside leg.
Sudanists everywhere pay attention. Yes, you aficionados and completists of all things sudden. Disciples of Saint Captain Maurice Frank Henry Urquhart, NACOM, Sedon, Royal Signals retired, deceased 2014, the unmissable is pending.
Director William English unpicks the life of the radical eccentric inventor Captain Maurice Sedon through archival material and 16mm film. Heated Gloves is a touching and unique look at the eccentricity and the modesty of Captain Maurice Sedon's way of life. Friday, the 16th of October, BFI Southbank at 6:20 p.m. Tickets are available at whatson.bfi.org.uk.
Well, that seems to be about the nearest waist size, doesn't it? The extra large, I think I'm going to wrap twice around me. If you could do that,
yes, I'll do that. All right, ring me and say 10 minutes.
I will do.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. Once again, I'm joined by the distinguished professor of film, Nicky Hamlin, author of Film Art Phenomena. Good afternoon, Nicky.
Good afternoon.
We are gathered here today before the festival. In fact, the festival has started, hasn't it? The 59th. BFI London Film Festival, in which we are both contributors.
That's right, yeah. So we can big ourselves up endlessly for the next hour. Well, not necessarily for a whole hour, but...
Exactly. Well, I've had my advert. That was my advert at the beginning, which, of course, is Heated Gloves, a film of Captain Maurice Sedon, which is, as stated in the advert, at 6:20 on Friday the 16th of October in NFT3. And your film is called Gasometers Part 3?
Yep. Yes, it's...
And this is part 3. So how many parts are there?
There are actually 3 parts, parts 2, 3 and 4. Part 1 got re-edited so it no longer really exists and became part 2. And part 3 is a study of the gasometer that's since been dismantled, which was behind the Edmonton IKEA, not just south of the North Circular Road.
Right.
It was a very, very large gasometer. Part 2 was a pair of gasometers in Tottenham, just to the west of the Edmondson one, only about half a mile away, which have also since been dismantled. In fact, part of the film shows the dismantling of them, and they're building a whole new village there with five, or town really, with 5,000 houses and shops and schools and everything, complete infrastructure.
Right.
And then the third part is a shorter film, which is of another pair of gasometers in Hornsey. But part 3, it's 6 100-foot 16mm takes in black and white and colour. It's all time-lapse, so I was shooting one frame every 12 seconds or something like that, day and night, black and white and colour, so you get a kind of permutation. You don't get a complete set of permutations, but you get 6 possible permutations of filming from the north to facing south and vice versa in colour or black and white by day and or by night. So
right.
So that's basically
a fairly strict method of process.
Yeah,
procedure.
The framing is the south facing framings are identical. So it goes from a black and white night shot straight into a colour day shot with exactly the same framing and exactly the same frame rate. And then the the north-facing ones, the framing slightly changes, but it's basically the same camera position. But it's because I put the camera, I hid the camera in a little in a copse in Tottenham Marshes, and I did a night shot, and then I went back and
You left the camera there?
Yeah, I just left it there. I realised that there are places where you can leave things and no one's ever going to find them.
Right.
I mean, they might do. People might have gone in there, I suppose, but it's highly unlikely. I kind of got a bit of a feel for this because when I was doing part two, I was filming from a small park which was just immediately to the north of this pair in Tottenham, and actually the park was made on land that was reclaimed from the gasworks, which is where the gasometers were situated. And it's fringed by a kind of, well, bushes, basically. So I just pushed the camera back into the bushes to film at night. So at night, you know, there's no one's going to find the, unless somebody saw me setting up. So I made sure when I set it up that there was nobody in the park.
Right.
And then I just left it there and went back in the morning and collected it. And then I was sort of emboldened by that.
So Bolex, is this?
Yeah, it's a 16, a Bolex with a clockwork Bolex, but with a Tobin electric time-lapse motor. So you just set it to take one frame every however often you want. And then it's battery powered, so you just leave it there. But obviously, because I was filming in the autumn, and so there was condensation on the lens, and that created all these extraordinary serendipitous effects, really, which I had not envisaged at all.
Hmm.
So it's quite a lucky film in that sense. Hmm. And that's what I quite like about working that way. You just set the camera up and leave it, and then you don't know exactly what you're going to get. I mean, you know what the framing is, but you don't know, you never can be sure what might happen. I mean, when I was setting the camera up, actually, I saw a whole family of foxes in the park.
Oh, right.
Four foxes all together.
Yeah.
That was quite
And do they appear in the frame? Or
no, no, they don't. But you see all kinds of things if you hang around in strange places, you know, in the wastelands of North London.
Yes. So what? Any particular reason for gasometers? Why gasometers have you focused on?
Because I'm sort of interested. I want a kind of an excuse to film the sky in a way.
Ah.
And I just like the interplay of light, these very fixed geometric structures, and then the movement of clouds and stuff around in relation to that. And actually, there's more of an interplay than you might imagine. The distinction between gasometer and clouds often blurs a bit, you know, depending on exactly where the sun is and where the clouds are. So you do get some quite surprising things happening.
Do they act like a sort of sundial, I suppose, as well?
Yeah, they
do.
There's one shot where, particularly where that's evident, and they cast shadows on themselves. So they could generate very complex shadow movements, and yeah, that's all part of the attraction for me of making it.
I know nothing about gasometers. Is it a technology that is on its way out?
Yeah,
or has already gone?
It's gone. Yeah, right. I mean, the when gas was made from coal, every town had a gasworks,
right?
And the gas that was made from the coal was stored in these drums, which went up and down inside this structure,
right?
And then later on, they developed kind of gasometers which didn't need the external structure, just the drums. So the ones I've been filming are the external skeleton which supports the drum, but the drums no longer go up and down. I think they only recently stopped going up and down.
I was going to say, there's one along the canal towards Hackney, isn't there? Or at least there's they're usually in groups of two or three.
They're often in groups,
And they used to go up and down until probably a couple of years ago, I think. I imagined it. But
I think they still use them for storage, but now they've got a more sophisticated piping system, I think.
Are they all due to be removed?
Most of them will be, except for the ones that are listed, like the ones at King's Cross and the one at the Oval. I think that's not listed, but it probably is going to be, because it always features on TV when they have the test match on, you know, cricket. It's become a kind of landmark. So there are a few that have been listed, but yeah, most of them are being demolished, actually.
So when do they date from, roughly?
From the end of the 19th century, mostly.
Oh, really?
Mostly. And into the 20th century.
Right.
But the ones I've been filming were all built around the 1880s, 1890s.
God, that's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Still sort of...
and they just cut them up with oxyacetylene torches. Just one man on a cherry picker with an oxyacetylene torch.
Yeah.
It's quite incredible and quite quick, actually, to bring them down.
So what do they do with the ones that are conserved then, or can't be knocked down? It's just a vacuum. I suppose they could turn it into something.
The thing is the ground...
A museum of gas or something.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, in other countries, like in Austria, they're made of brick and they're completely different. And a lot of them have been turned into flats. But these ones obviously can't do that. And the ground is very polluted by the coal gas-making process. It's very toxic. all the soil has to be removed, and then it can be, and then the ground can be reused for other things like houses or whatever.
Right.
And there are large areas. The gasworks took up. The
King's Cross ones were sort of painted red and black, weren't they? Did they take them away completely and then bringing them back again?
Or there's one that was left, and the others are supposed to be rebuilt around these apartment blocks that they're building there.
Right, right.
Re-erected around them.
So yours, the ones in your film, they don't go up and down then?
No.
Because that
well,
fades.
The one, the first pair, it did go up a little bit, and I filmed it. They were pumping water out of it. It was quite strange. So I got a black and white sequence of this water being pumped out.
Right.
But I think they haven't really been used. Well, since North Sea gas was discovered, you know, in the 60s, they stopped making gas from coal more or less around that time. And so it's been a long time that natural gas has replaced coal gas. And so it's surprising that they, but I suppose they kept them for storage. They just kept the gasometers for storage, but the actual gas works were dismantled.
Right.
And now all the gasometers are being dismantled as well.
So so this film, Gasometer Part 3, is showing in the festival on Thursday.
6:40.
Where are we now? Friday. So next Thursday at what time?
6:40.
6:40
in the evening.
In a themed sort of group of films.
Towards Nature, I think it's called, the programme.
Right.
It's loosely around sort of nature and the urban, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're both actually in the what they call the experimenter section of the BFI catalogue, which of course is the right at the very end, past sort of family and all the rest of it, but still, there we are.
But were you going to say something about your film, or do people?
I think it's all sort of been said. I think I don't think I've got anything to add other than it's about Captain Maurice Seddon, Royal Signals retired, and includes archive footage. And yes, I mean, I don't want to say too much about it. I suppose it does. Include, I suppose, what you might call a sort of survey of technologies, in that it starts with standard 8 footage and ends with iPhone footage. So, because I was filming him over such a long period of time, it's sort of technologies came and went during that period. So we can perhaps recap on that later. Do you want to play a track, or do you want to tell me about your broken toe?
Oh, well, that would be a way into, because I brought a couple of music things as well. Well, the broken toe, in the summer, I was on the island of Porquerolles.
I'm not laughing at the broken toe.
I don't mind if you do.
No, it must have been extremely painful, I should say.
Well, no, it wasn't at the time. I just looked down and saw, I put my foot into a culvert, and then I felt something, and I looked down and my toe was bent over at a funny angle. Right. So I actually bent it back.
God.
Not quite far enough, because I didn't want to damage it, but I didn't feel any pain. I mean, later it was painful, but at the time I did it, I didn't really feel any pain. I was trying to hide my camera under a bush, because I was filming on this island, Porquerolles, which is also where the final scene of Pierre Le Fou was shot, where Belmondo blows himself up.
Right.
And the cabanon that he goes to is still there, and you can visit it.
So what was still there?
The kind of cabin thing that he...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Where he gets the dynamite out and wraps it around his head.
Yeah, sticks the dynamite around
and
his
then
head.
Has second thoughts. He lights the fuse and then has second thoughts, but by then
it's too late. So he sort of, is he painted blue at that time?
Yeah, he paints his face blue first.
Yeah, so the incredible colours, aren't they?
Yeah, the yellow dynamite, I think, and red. Maybe some red as well. He's got yellow dynamite and red dynamite in these.
And then the blue sky, of course, the Mediterranean sky, and his blue painted face.
Yeah,
and this is on the island of Porquerolles, which is off. Which used to have a little film festival of its own, didn't it?
Oh, did it?
It used to be, yes. It had, for some, God knows why it was in here, but there was a sort of film gathering there once upon a time.
It's also where the Villa Noailles is built. Is there, and it's where the Mystère du Château du Day. The Man Ray film was shot in that house, so there's also that film connection.
Right,
but
right.
I was filming these concrete blocks. I saw these 6 concrete blocks in a field, and I've always been a bit kind of interested in systems, and I had this idea to film the first block with the second block in the shot, and then the third block in the shot, and then the fourth block, and then move on to the second block with the first block in the shot, and then the second block and the third block, second block and fourth and fifth, and then so on. So I do a completely exhaustive set of shots where every block was filmed with one of the other blocks in the frame at the same time. So there'd always be two blocks in the frame. Right. But unfortunately, well, I ran out of film before I finished the system. But then also I broke my toe and I had to sort of stop at that point. So
right.
I mean, I might try and do it again. But then I was thinking about complete systems, exhaustive systems, because in a way the gasometer's film is also it doesn't permutate all the possible combinations that I mentioned before. But then I sort of thinking about that in relation to music, and J.S. Bach wrote this. You know, people don't realize, but he was a very innovative and experimental, well, not innovative in a really radical sort of way, but he was an experimenter, a bit like Alfred Hitchcock was an experimenter in cinema, you know. Hmm. And he wrote this piece called The Little Harmonic Labyrinth, which moves through all of the 24 major, 12 major and 12 minor keys in the tempered scale. So it starts off in C major, C minor, C sharp major, C sharp minor, and so on, all the way back to the beginning. And so it's a kind of exhausts one set of parameters, the 12 semitones of the tempered scale.
Right. And on what? Which instrument?
Played on an organ.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, by Bernard Fruquerol.
Yeah.
And it's about 4 minutes long.
Okay, we'll play this.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's from the complete organ works of Johann Sebastian Bach.
Yeah, played on a Silbermann organ. He was a famous organ builder from Hamburg, and so those recordings they're all played on period instruments, and so the tunings of the organs they're not tuned like a modern keyboard where the interval between each semitone is equal. The tuning is unequal in order to create some ideally sort of perfect harmonic intervals. But there's a compromise between perfect thirds and fourths something like that, and then the modern equal scale. Mm. So it's the tuning is somewhere between the two, and the differences are quite subtle. But
did he prepare the organ in some way?
Bach also.
Oh right, that's interesting.
Well, so Bach certainly did, because he knew a lot about organs and how they were made, and he was invited a lot to sort of test all new ones out and stuff like that.
Right.
And he was a kind of virtuoso in his 20s. He wrote a lot of organ music in his 20s and was a complete virtuoso at playing. But I just think it's interesting. Well, it's a sort of systems piece in a way.
Hmm.
And, I mean, he also wrote this, the preludes and fugues to be played in all the different keys. And, again, to be played on instruments that weren't tuned in the modern way. So you'd get subtle harmonic, different kinds of colour in the sound that you wouldn't get when they're played on a modern piano.
Right.
I mean, it's a whole technical. There's a whole world of. There are lots and lots of different tuning systems for keyboards. You know, for
mm-hmm.
Western music.
Right.
Anyway, there's a sort of connection then. So that was like he takes those 24 keys, and there's a little bit in each key. So it's exhaustive in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tom Johnson, this American composer, wrote this piece called Chord Catalog, which it has all the possible combinations of chords that you can get out of the 12 notes on the octave. So all the possible combinations of two notes, three notes, four notes, five notes, up to 12, right. And they're just played through, and it's quite bizarre. It's so I thought we could maybe listen to a bit
indeed,
of that.
Indeed, yes.
And it starts with the two.
Okay, so shall we play that next?
Yeah.
So what is it? This is called the 78 two note chords.
Yeah.
And what are we going to hear? We're going to hear two or three pieces from this.
Yeah, if we listen to the two note ones, that's the shortest bit.
Yeah. All right,
we'll see how it goes after that.
Okay. I was hoping it would go straight into the next one.
It might not do.
Actually, there's a sort of spinning wheel. Does that mean it's going to do something?
That probably means...
So many steps to cleansing.
Oh, dear.
Just got into an
We're doing it on YouTube, sure. That's why.
Okay, so now... What's this? Like a Garnier or something?
Removes makeup.
Skip out.
Cleanses.
Skip. Well, that's the end of that. I've managed to avoid the Garnier advert that time, but it's a sort of good excuse for me to suddenly slip this in, which is a sort of, I hope, Wrong track. Hang on. Lots of errors here. Here we go. You recognise this because this is the Bach organ music. Mm. So, what I should be playing is this.
Video games.
So that was.
What was that?
Well, that was instead of it was in response to the Garnier advert.
Oh, right.
That was Atari Video Games logo by Ciani. Who she's sort of like a radiophonics workshop type person,
right,
who did lots of experimental work,
right,
including lots of strange little adverts. In fact, I could possibly even play, since they're so short, why not play another one? An All May Eclipse TV spot. Suzanne Ciani. Yes. So back to you, Nicky Hamlin. Mm. where were we? Tom Johnson.
Yeah.
You're going to talk about have we covered systems music?
I think so. Yeah. It was just. I quite like making these connections between. Well, as people do. Just the idea that, certainly with film, however rigid the system you have, there are always variations that are possible. You know, the weather is going to be different, or there are all any number of imponderables, and you always have to start from somewhere. So the premises for your system are always, to some extent, the opposite of. They're contingent, you choose them. So I'm just kind of interested in that relationship. And I mean, with the concrete blocks, I realised actually I'll probably have to reshoot the whole thing because I wasn't rigorous enough about how I placed the adjacent block in relation to the main one in each
Did
sequence.
Did you place that? You moved the blocks?
No. I meant how I lined them up.
Oh, you placed them.
They were sort of found,
But these are in Porquerolle, in the Mediterranean.
Yeah, in a field.
You're going to have to go back to Porquerolle?
If I want to remake the film, I'm not sure whether it will work in the way I thought it would, so I may not remake it, but I might do. It all depends on various other things.
So you must be particularly fascinated by these particular blocks.
Not especially, although at different times of day the light at different times of day changes them dramatically, because they're big square things, rectangular things. Early in the morning the light is totally different, obviously, to midday and then to later in the afternoon. So those are the kind of imponderables that I'm interested in, but I have to work out a more rigorous way of framing them in relation to each other. I was a bit sloppy this time, but you learn from your mistakes, and hopefully next time, if I decide to do it again, I'll do it.
Were you in part of some group show recently, Analog or something? I saw you part of some show.
Oh,
somewhere.
that's tomorrow. That's at Apiary Studios.
Oh well, you should give us a plug then.
Yeah, that's Apiary Studios tomorrow, and it's a combination of paintings and film. So there'll be paintings by. Well, I'm showing a film, Correspondences, which is made from some paintings by Angela Allen. And it was shown in Camden Arts Centre a couple of years ago in the festival, Guy Sherwin curated. So it's a film made from these paintings. And the paintings are almost like a score for the film. So the paintings will be there, and then the film will be shown in the adjacent room. And then there's paintings by Noel Forster and films by Simon Payne, one of the curators, actually. Simon Payne, Andrew Valance, and Gareth Palmier.
Simon Payne, he's you call him a filmmaker?
Well, a video artist,
something.
Yeah.
It's digital, isn't it?
Yeah, it's totally digital. It's most of his work, a lot of his work, is generated on a computer.
They often look like the test sort of test card.
In fact, when he started making computer-based pieces, he used the test card colours, and it was the whole thing was to get, again, to have something that was kind of given, you know, a sort of given right. element, and then make something with that.
Yeah.
So he, again, he kind of permutated all possible combinations of that in various ways and through a number of pieces. But he's recently gone back to using a camera to actually film things. They're still quite similar looking works, but they're...
That's surprising. What film?
Handheld camera.
Gosh.
Yeah, right. So in a cautious way, he's moved back towards a kind of filming, you know, more conventional way of working, if you like.
But not actually film?
No, no, it's video.
No, it's still video. No, it's
all right. I shouldn't be saying
film. It is confusing these
filming
days,
as a verb. You know.
Yeah. But, so that's at the Apiary Studios.
It's tomorrow and Sunday, actually.
Right. What time? Roughly?
I can't remember.
In the evening?
Yeah, I think it starts
probably 8 o'clock.
Then. Yeah, something like that. Sorry, I should know.
That's all right.
I've had a lot of other things on my mind.
You are in the show.
Yeah, I'm in it, yeah.
So this is a collaboration between you and the painter Angela Allen,
yeah.
Who you have collaborated with in the past.
We did two. I also made a film of one of her drawings, just a single drawing. These paintings, it's a set of four, and there's a black and white one, and then there's three which use complementary colour relations, green and red and so on.
Right.
So it's actually four pictures, but four paintings make up one piece of work.
Right.
That, and the film is all based around that, or derived from that.
Yeah.
A lot of it shot like an animation, sort of frame by frame. And
yeah. Okay, so this is you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with Nikki Hamlin, who has, as myself, we both have films in the film festival, which actually started on Wednesday, I think, and runs until the 18th.
Yeah.
You were in a festival. Well, perhaps you've been in many festivals, but I do remember you having a New York Film Festival bag once. You were kind of walking around with a New York film. Is that an experience that was worth recounting? Probably not.
Not all especially. Right. No. I mean, I was in it about 3 years ago last time. It's in Lincoln Center, which is a bit of a kind of dead area. You're kind of a bit stuck there, really. It's not very easy to find anywhere to eat or drink around there, and it's a bit... But they have very good projection, and it's a good event. Although I think it's changed now; it's not happening in the same way anymore.
Is that just the regular festival, which had an experimental dip section,
a bit like the London one does,
and
the Toronto one does as well,
And is there interest? I mean, do they get a big audience?
They're always in. Oh, it used to be in Alice Tully Hall. I can't remember, but I think it moved to another one. Yeah, you get good audiences. Yeah, big audience. Yeah.
Yeah,
probably 300, 400 people.
Wow, okay.
Quite a lot.
Hmm.
Well,
we're both in NFT 3, which has a capacity of 130.
Yeah, which I always think is not enough, actually, because they always seem to sell out those things, and there are lots of disappointed people who can't get tickets. So I think they could afford to be a bit more generous with... You know, having it maybe in NFT 2, but...
Well, there's still 30 tickets left for my film.
All right.
So...
Well...
You're on the guest list.
I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, where shall we go from there? You've brought in a cassette, haven't you?
It's an old audio arts cassette of British experimental music. And I just thought this would make a nice contrast to the Bach and the Tom Johnson. It's a piece by Howard Skempton, a waltz, and he had this... Hmm. At this time, at least in his career, he was trying to write music that was as simple as possible. So it's the opposite end of the scale in terms of complexity to something like Bach. So I just thought it'd make a nice contrast to the last two things that we heard, really.
Okay, I'll try and get the cassette player to... Should be all right.
I haven't listened to this for a long time. I hope it's still okay. Thank you.
do something sacrilegious and fade it out.
Yeah,
I don't know how long that piece is.
No, I can't remember either. But it's also a kind of permutative piece, and it's very didactic. It has a very transparent structure, which is also, I mean, that was one of the things I was interested in with using with the film of the block, concrete blocks. You know, would it, if you exhaust a particular set of possibilities, does the work become rather boring and predictable and didactic? You know, but I don't think it does. I mean, it's very measured, that piece. It's very ploddy, and I mean, but that's all deliberate. And I quite like that, actually.
Well, you're obviously interested in systems. But I wonder if, I suppose the thing with film is that, are you at all interested in the what the image signifies, as it were? Because I mean, with music and painting, you are starting from something that doesn't actually represent anything else. I mean, for instance, the gasometers or the concrete blocks? Does it interest you at all what they represent or signify
the concrete blocks they are real objects in the real world, and it is a documentary film in that sense, and as is the gasometers, but it's not a film about the history of gasometers or what they kind of their relationship to industrialization and electric power and all those
things. But can you avoid the connotations?
No, I mean, it has those connotations, but the work doesn't really have any meaning beyond that.
Is there something you wouldn't film because of the connotations? I mean, if the concrete blocks had some connotation that you did not like, would you then say, "I'm not going to film those concrete blocks"?
Yeah, I might do, because
so you are aware of what they are about.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, sure, but what they have in common, and in a way, what the paintings, Angela's paintings, have as well. They don't have any metaphorical dimension to them. They're not allegorical or metaphorical. They don't. They are, and again, they're also systemic. I mean, the paintings use the three color complementary color relationships, or orange and blue, green and red, and purple and yellow.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not about anything else other than that, really. And the film generates a lot of effects, a lot of kinetic things happen in the film just by the way it's filmed. So it's not as if it makes it a more simple experience by not having a metaphorical or allegorical aspect to it. And yeah, Bach's music is all abstract. Well, I mean, not all of it. Some of it. A lot of it's set. You know, he's setting religious texts, but the music itself. There's lots of numerological things in it, actually, as well, but which I'm not interested in per se. But I just think, I mean, the Tom Johnson piece, by taking this rather extreme, I mean, in a way, it's very unmusical what he's doing. Even though it's music and it's played on musical instruments, it's very unmusical. It's a lot less musical than so much music you hear, which is generated electronically or, you know, is highly processed. So it's a strange experience listening to the Tom Johnson, to hear this piece played in a very, very perfunctory way.
Yeah. What's the Skempton from? Can you tell me what's on the cassette?
Yeah, it's an Audio Arts. I've had it for a long time. I haven't played it for a while. It sounded a bit rough, actually. It's an Audio Arts from 1976, Volume 3, Number 2, with pieces by Gavin Bryars, Michael Nyman, Christopher Hobbs, Michael Parsons, John White, James Lampard and Howard Skempton.
Right.
And John White, and Michael Parsons, and John Tilbury is also, well, they're all still alive, these people, and
John Tilbury's playing the piano on that, isn't he?
No, it's actually, I think it's actually John White. It is John Tilbury, yes, right. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, he gave a concert about a year ago now, maybe a bit more than a year, at Cafe Otto, where he played Howard Skempton and Michael Parsons pieces.
Right.
And they're all part of that, they're all connected through Cornelius Cardew and the Scratch Orchestra.
Tilbury was one of AMM, wasn't he?
Yeah, Mm-hmm. And that produced lots of interesting stuff, I think.
Right. So next you've brought in some things by Philip Jeck.
Yeah.
You have a connection here, I think.
Well, only in the sense that my line manager, actually he's not my line manager anymore, but a colleague at the Royal College of Art, where I teach one day a week, John Wozencroft, is one of the... he's one of the two people who runs Touch label with with someone called Mike Harding, and they've been doing it for over 30 years, and they've done a lot of very interesting stuff. And he recently very kindly gave me a double LP of this new double LP by Philip Jeck, which is, they're all quite short pieces made by using a combination of instruments and turntables and then things like mini disc players. And so it's an quite an interesting mix of technology that he's using.
So the two that you've brought in, they're both called St. Pancras.
Yeah.
Curiously, why are they both called St. Pancras?
I have no idea. All the pieces on the record are named after specific places.
Okay. So should we play one of these?
Yeah.
Are they 4 minutes?
Well, there's a 2 minute one, and one of them's four and the other's two.
Let's start with the shorter one.
Yeah,
I think. So that's Philip Jeck on the Touch label.
Yeah, it's from a brand new double LP.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really sorry, I can't remember the title of it. It's just out now, really.
Right.
And they're always beautifully produced. Those Touch records, they're beautifully designed, and everything about the quality is very high in terms of engineering and everything.
Yeah. Does he always feature church organs, Philip Jack?
No, I don't. No? I mean, I haven't really followed his career closely. But he used to do lots of work with turntables, and he had a piece in that show that was at, I think it was at the Hayward Gallery of, it was all Sonic related work.
Was it called Sonic Boom? Or
yeah,
something?
Sonic. I think it was called Sonic Boom, and there
was a Christian Marclay film in it. And yeah,
a lot of those people that work with sound, but who are sort of artists but work with sound, as opposed to being musicians. And he had a piece in there which was, he had a lot of those kind of cheap portable turntables or just cheap turntables playing various things. And I think that was quite an early piece, but obviously, it's moved on since then. But
yeah, I've got a record by him which is also church organ music.
Oh, right,
I thought maybe that's all he did. But
hang around in churches.
Yes. Well, okay. Well, we were going to go into balloons, but we're rapidly running out of time. I don't think we've got time, actually. Yeah. You've brought in a Matunas CD.
Yeah, which is also newish, and it was done by Apartment House, ensemble, who do lots of contemporary experimental music, and it's a piece that he wrote, a flux piece for a balloon to be played, basically. So it's a wonderfully simple idea, and again, I suppose it prefigures a lot of what's going on now. It's become very, very common, people doing sound, improvised music and sound with using ordinary objects. But this must be a very early example of that, unless you include cages.
This is 1962.
Yeah.
It's called Solo for Balloons. Mm. And is it by Matunas himself?
Yeah. He scored it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So all these pieces are, he just wrote scores, and then people play the score, use the score, or the instructions.
Right.
And I think often the score is like a grid, a bit like Morton Feldman used for some of his early, and Caged also used occasionally a sort of grid, which you just use the grid to generate the sequence of events, really.
Right. Yes, we were going to have a balloon theme, but it definitely won't have to. I brought in The Anti-Concept by Gilles J. Volman, which was a film that was projected onto a large helium-filled balloon.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary film, actually.
Yeah, and that dates from about 1951 or 52. But there's absolutely no way that I'm going to have time to play that. So should we play out with the solo for balloons, then?
Yeah, if you
by
like.
George Matunas.
Mm.
So you've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with guest Nicky Hamlin, whose film Gasometer Part 3, or is it Gasometers?
Gasometers.
Sorry, Gasometers Part 3 is a part of the film festival, and that's next Thursday. Well, that film screens as part of a programme next Thursday at 6 o'clock. You've got a film tomorrow in Apiary Studios.
Yes.
Tomorrow and Sunday.
Yeah, it's paintings and films. It's a mixed show, and it runs on Sunday as well.
Yeah.
So on Sunday, the show is open, and there'll be a video loop projection of the work, the films. But on Saturday evening, it's proper film projections.
Okay.
A programme.
Right.
And you've got a film on, your film is on Friday.
Indeed, Heated Gloves, but I shall be plugging that remorselessly for the next. We've got an advert on Resonance, which will be repeating as a loop for the next 10 days. so that's all right. We can bypass that one for now. Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Nicky, for coming in.
No, thanks. I enjoyed it.
So we'll end up with Solo for Balloons by George Matunas.